Windows down, music up. Get ready to hit the road in a new Chevy SUV or truck. Chevy is a name you know and trust. It's Chevy as American as apple pie and baseball. Check out the full line of Chevy vehicles at your local Chevy dealer. Chevy, drive Chicago.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're here. Thanks very much for tuning in. You know, you can subscribe to the podcast at Spotify or Apple or here at WGNRadio.com, wherever you get your podcasts. Anyway, I'm glad you found it this week. And in the book, Everything is Beautiful and Nothing Hurts, author Ben Reeves borrows the title from Kurt Vonnegut, but everything else is wonderfully original. This is a special book, and I'm kind of afraid to describe it myself, so we'll leave it to the author. Ben Reeves, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, tell me about your story.
Of course. So I like to say it's a book about life told from the point of view of death. So death is the main character of this book. And he, in many ways, he's just a normal guy. He's called Travis. He lives in an apartment building. He has a cat. And his job is to spend time with people in the last few moments of life. And he will just sit with them, listen to their stories, offer them comfort, and he will never judge or try to interfere in any way. He's just there as a kind of usher at the very end. So throughout the story, we get to see all these vignettes of different people's lives, young people, old people, sick people, people who are ready to die, people who aren't ready to die. And we get to see Travis spend time with these people in the last few moments of life. And that can sound quite sad, but it's also a very uplifting story because it forces us to think a little bit more about the things that are important in our lives, the things that we take for granted, the things that if we had more time, we might pay more attention to. And it's the story kind of unfolds because Travis, he likes to be alone. You can imagine being death. You wouldn't want to spend too much time with people outside of your role as death, because you know that every single person you make friends with is going to eventually die and you're going to watch them die.
And he can see how they're going to die at the time.
He does. Yeah. He knows. Yeah. But then one day he meets a little family that live across the hall, a single mother who's a midwife named Dahlia and her two little girls. And Travis, against his better judgment, he just can't help but be drawn to this beautiful little family, and things unfold from there.
When you were describing one of the deaths early in the book, you wrote that 15 people saw the man jump. 10 of them asked themselves why they feel nothing. That seems to me to be kind of there can be several cruxes. One of the cruxes of the book in that we just are so consumed with our lives that we're not really living it. Flesh that out for me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think we get so caught up in the day-to-day stresses. And obviously we do all have stressful lives and real things to worry about. But when you're stuck in traffic, or if you knock over a vase that you like, you know, it can be so easy to just take those things and really let them consume you in the moment, when really those things just, when you really contemplate the fact, actually one day this is going to end, you will not care about that vase or being stuck in traffic. You will actually be so grateful that you're even alive at all to be stuck in traffic. You'll look out the window and think, actually, this is absolutely beautiful. One day I'm going to be, you know, maybe I'll be 90 years old and I would give anything to be back in this moment. And it's funny that you chose that specific line, because that's based on a real thing that I saw. I saw a man jump in front of a train and hit the front of the train. And it was a couple of years before I started writing this book, but it definitely got me thinking, I think, about these things.
And you talk about engineers of trains and what they see also in the book, which I have heard elsewhere is just absolutely horrific. I'm sorry you went through that. Travis seems to be both dispassionate and compassionate at the same time. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think it is. So he really takes his role very seriously. He has a lot of respect for people and for life and for death. He really treats it with a great reverence. But when he's not being death, when he's just a man in his downtime, he has to try. Well, actually, let me step back a bit. even when he is being death, although he's taking it very seriously, he can't allow himself to feel so passionately about every single person who's going to die, because he just wouldn't be able to be this entity. He wouldn't be able to do this role. He can't let them all in. And that's why when he does meet this family, knowing that one day they will die, he does let them in, and maybe against his better judgment.
Yeah, I want to talk about the family, obviously, but one more question about Travis and his role in that. The people he comes to visit at their death, sometimes he'll visit before they die or visit a few times, and those who are going to die can actually see him, and they often or always know who he is, right? They take him, they accept him in as a visitor.
That's right, yeah. So I wanted Travis to almost mold himself to what that person needs. So, for example, there's a kind of shut-in guy whose house is full of rubbish and he hasn't stepped outside in years. And Travis turns up on the doorstep with a mop and bucket and he's wearing overalls and they clean the house together. Or there's another scene where he's kind of an attorney sorting out the will, because he's just there to offer them whatever they might need in that moment. And that was really fun to play with, actually, to try and think about, you know, some people, he might visit them just in the last few moments, the very last few moments. Some mm-hmm. people, it might be days or even weeks. He might return a few times. If someone gets cancer in the book, he might visit them shortly after the diagnosis and then again later at the end when he's ready to take them.
There's one man who is, he wears a helmet inside because he's so worried about protecting himself. And yet when he needed to, he didn't protect his own children. There was only one where it seemed the man who ate too much or, you know, indulged too much. That seemed to be the only one that Travis, he kind of turned on that guy.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
How come?
So that's quite late in the book. And what I wanted to show, it wasn't Travis's any particular prejudice against people indulging or anything like that. But by that point in the book, Travis is starting to change. He is starting to think about things differently. He is starting to take things to heart. Because something happens in the middle of the book that sort of sets Travis on this path. And it's really a journey of him almost becoming more human. He is starting to, that particular death that you mentioned, it makes him angry because this person's sort of wasting his life. You know, that Travis sees all these people that have these beautiful, beautiful lives. And then there's this guy who's smoking and drinking and eating too much and not really looking after himself, and that does annoy Travis in that moment towards the end of the book.
All right, to Dahlia and her daughters Layla and Neda, I it's difficult to talk about this, right? Because we don't want to give away too much, but suffice to say, he does make an emotional connection with the family. There is great sadness that this family endures, and of course, Travis not only sees it coming, he's there at the moment it happens. But differently this time is that he sticks around a little bit and he tries to, even up until the last moment, he tries to detach himself. But it's a very difficult thing to do, and that he has to wrestle with this. And in the rest of the book is about how he wrestles with it and the outcome of it. I don't know what more to say. I mean, I don't want to give anything away. It's a truly special book. And I don't know, do you want to say anything more about the plot line?
Yeah. So it was important to me that I showed some kind of journey of our main character, because that's almost what a story is. You want to take a character and transform them, make them change in some way throughout the course of the story, because if you don't have that, you almost haven't got a story. So I thought long and hard about what my death would be like, as in my character of death, and what sort of journey would he go on. And I thought it'd be really beautiful to explore this guy who's very, he has to be distant, he has to be impartial, but to then unwittingly get sucked in by this beautiful little family. And in a way, what he is drawn to is just how normal they are and how they're getting to live this very normal life, very simple life of just, you know, going to school and having dinner and stuff. Travis finds that very appealing. And obviously he must have met lots and lots of people in his life like that. But it's, in particular, it's this little girl, Layla, who draws Travis in. She takes an interest in him. She shows him things like photographs that she takes and things like that. And he, through her, gets involved in this little family.
Okay, so talk to me about the writing of this. You have a way of, I feel like, changing the narrator of a paragraph within a sentence. Are you right? Did you do that?
Yeah, I do that, and not all readers like it, understandably. What the reason I did that is because I wanted my Travis, my version of Death, to almost be omniscient. He can sort of see everything. He's very in tune with the world, with nature, and very often, actually, when it seems like it is changing point of view, so I might be describing, say, a meadow, and it seems like it's third person because there's no character there. It's actually in first person. I just don't ever say I. It's Travis describing this meadow, and it's Travis describing everything in the book. But it's, you don't always, he's not always there. It's an interesting one. I like to call it first person omniscient, and I don't know if that's a thing. But
you created it. Yeah. Right. So that's a good way to put it. So even when you think he's not there, just like death, he's always there.
Yeah, for me, absolutely. Yeah.
Another part of the thing that you did is you would take a moment and then you would describe all the things that are happening in the world at that moment. Twins are born here. A woman dies there. You did that a few times. Tell me about those passages, because they are, I think, truly remarkable in that they describe, or they bring in, the universality of all of us, that we're all happening all together all at once, even though we're not aware of it.
Well, thank you. That's one of my favorite comments that anybody's ever given me about the book, because those are some of my favorite bits as well. I love and I really miss it, and I'm trying to think of other ways to do it in other books. Getting into that mode where you're almost, as you say, you're everywhere all at once. You're experiencing all these different things in this, hopefully, this beautiful unfolding manner. They were so fun to write, and the way I tend to write those was I walk quite a lot, and on these walks I would look around and think about, well, why is that ambulance parked there? Or I can smell barbecue smoke, like who's having that barbecue, and what's going on in that window up there, and really think about the world the way Travis might see things, because he can see everything. Just a pure pleasure to write that way.
I tell you, I was flying when I was reading this book. So and the universality of it, or the fact that it's about everything, every aspect of life. I found, we were out visiting my daughter in Los Angeles. She's 30 years old, and we're flying home, and I just start getting weepy. And even now, it strikes me, because reading your book, and I don't know what the particular passage was, but it made me realize that she doesn't need me anymore. You know, certainly she does in some ways, but there was something in the book, something about, in general, about life and passages and maturity and immaturity, and that it made me realize that about my own life. And I think people who read this book carefully will have experiences similar to that. I would imagine that's your goal.
Yeah, and that means a lot to me. I'm going for a similar thing. My kids are 9 and 12, so obviously quite different, but sure, also sort of the same. And what that does, you know, realizing, oh, maybe they don't, you know, my little boy doesn't play with toys anymore. What that does is make you appreciate things even more, I think, and realize you can hold on to things in the moment, and it's okay that things change. Like, that's okay. That is part of life. And as long as I'm appreciating it right now, and I'm not just snapping at someone when they don't deserve it, or, you know, an example I love to use is my little boy hands me a picture he's drawn, and I could just say, oh, that's very nice, and throw it to one side. Right. Or I could really, really look at this picture that he's drawn and and really appreciate it and savor the fact that my little boy has just drawn me this picture. And yeah, that's absolutely something I wanted to try and almost wake you up, wake myself
right,
up.
Sure, yeah. I'm sitting at LAX reading the book, waiting for my plane, and the woman walks by and she goes, "How's that book? I've heard about it. I need to read it."
Really?
And I said, "Well, I don't think it's out yet." And she said, "Well, I have a friend in London who's read it." So already word of mouth is spreading on this. I would imagine the reviews have been, or your response here in the States now has been pretty positive. What do you make of all that? This could be big.
It's overwhelming. I try not to think about it too much because I'm just happy that it's happening at all. But it's, that everybody's been, people who love it really, really, really love it. There's a few people that maybe it's too sad or whatever, but people that stick with it to the end, they realize how uplifting it is. And I hope people really love it. That would be a dream come true.
It is uplifting, and you have to stick with it. They're like life, or moments of sadness and great moments of hope. How's your response been? Are you doing book signings or things like that, or what are you doing in the States?
Yeah, I'm doing some signings today at a bookshop called Books Are Magic in Brooklyn. I've got some stock signings tomorrow. There's all sorts of fun things going on. It's a bit crazy, actually.
Well, enjoy it, because it's a beautiful book, and it was a moving story. And you mentioned that some people think it's too sad. I really hope that doesn't keep people away, because in the end, it's not. And in the end, you give us a 20-minute gift, which is something that it's special. So thank you for that, Ben.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Ben Reeves. The name of the book is Everything is Beautiful and Nothing Hurts. This is Steve Bertrand on Books. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you'll check us out next week as well. You can subscribe, at Apple or Spotify, WGNradio.com. And I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on our talk with Ben or anyone else at SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. Fantastic. All right, we'll talk again soon.